Nightingale Conant presents Wayne Dyer, Choosing Your Own Greatness, an approach to self-discovery and personal fulfillment.
Everybody deserves our love. And until we start thinking that way, we're going to always have dichotomies. We're going to always have you versus me, us versus them. And as long as there's that usness and me-ness and you-ness, there will never be a all of us together. Your thought processes create the images that you have. Those images create the behavior. And you can't back one up from the other unless you're willing to think that it's going to work out, and that's the premise you're operating from. That's a very important point for people if they want to be enlightened. If you believe that it's going to work out, then you'll start to see opportunities. If you don't, then you'll see obstacles. I've never believed that people who work real hard and do all the right things make a lot of money and then become successful. I think it's the other way around. I think successful people make a lot of money at whatever they do and make a lot of friends and all of that, because the successful person is someone who has it within them. When you are looking for love, it will always elude you. When you're looking for happiness, it will always elude you. When you become those things, it's just there, and it begins to own you. You don't have it. It has you. It has a hold of you.
At Nightingale Conant, we've discovered that you and others who include cassette listening in their way of life can truly be described as people seeking greater enlightenment. And we've also discovered that enlightened people don't resist change. They choose change and make it happen. In their own lives, they choose to change and grow, and then change and grow some more. Wayne Dyer is one of those rare individuals who has repeatedly celebrated this quality of change and growth, both in his cassettes and books, and also in his approach to living the most fulfilling life possible. Author of the highly acclaimed self-discovery cassette programs, How to Be a No-Limit Person, and Secrets of the Universe, and the best-selling books, Your Erroneous Zones, Pulling Your Own Strings, The Sky's the Limit, and Gifts from Icus, Dr. Dyer is one of America's best-known contemporary psychologists. In this, the newest of his cassette programs, Dr. Dyer continues to share his profound and inspirational perceptions through a series of live engagements which have inspired his listeners to smiles, tears, and often laughter, but never failed to touch them with a greater sense of self-understanding and personal enlightenment. You are also about to experience a unique look into the person behind the public image of world-renowned author, speaker, psychologist. We had the pleasure of recording Dr. Dyer at our Nightingale Conant studios. Throughout these interview segments, you will note an almost dramatic calm, a stillness in Dr. Dyer. That stillness seems to perfectly depict the inner calm of a man who has explored all the realms of self-discovery and comes to you today to share what he has learned. Some of what you hear may surprise you, and some may serve to comfort you on the path you already travel. You also can find inspiration and motivation to seek the light of your own sense of purpose and individual life vision. You can make your way to lasting fulfillment in the life that you live today at this moment. And this moment can be the beginning of a major change for you. It can be, in the truest sense, a turning point. It is for this reason that Dr. Dyer has chosen to begin the program with an anecdote in which he shares a deeply moving story concerning his relationship with his father, a relationship which existed for years in the pain of inner suffering and unforgiving resentment for a father he never knew. This, as you will hear, was just such a turning point for Wayne Dyer. And the conclusion of the story? Well, let's join Wayne as he unfolds this poignant drama.
I got to tell you that back in 1975, I had just come off of a phenomenal experience. I had been searching for my father from the time I was 8 years old. And I had dreams about him all the time. I had never seen this man, and he had been extremely cruel to everybody that he had ever met in his life. All references to him had been most unflattering. His life was an ignominious one in almost every way. And yet, there was something inside of me. There was a vengeance. There was an anger. There was a pain. There was a suffering. There was something inside of me that wanted to talk to this man and find out, how do you abandon three children? How do you do that? And how do you leave a woman and never pay her any child support? And how do you beat somebody up and rape them and create a pregnancy that way? And how do you use alcohol to destroy yourself? And the endless stories that I had heard, sort of backhand, because it was too painful even for my mother to talk about. How do you do that? Where does that come from? And I wanted to know, because somehow I thought maybe his leaving was courageous. Maybe he just couldn't stay and face it, and maybe he loved them so much and he had to leave. Who knows? If you don't know, you just wonder, don't you? And you just think about it. And I thought about it. My other two brothers couldn't have cared less about any of it. They were not interested at all. They didn't have any memory either. My oldest brother had some slight memory, but my next brother didn't. He was with me through the whole time. And so, I must tell you this because it really is relevant. When your purpose starts to become commensurate with what you are doing, when your life each day is exactly the same as what you believe you are here for, suddenly, and it is suddenly, your purpose begins to own you. And you get on such a fast track that nothing can stop you anyway. All right? And this purpose, whatever it may be related to anything in your life. Each one of us has it, and it is a magnificent purpose. And when you live it, it starts to own you. That's the only way I can say it. And this business about my father and the anguish and the pain and the suffering and the dreams and so on wouldn't go out of my life. And in 1975, I was in Columbus, Mississippi, at a school. I think it's called the Mississippi State College for Women or something like that. I had gone to several colleges. I was working for the government. I was a professor at St. John's University in New York. And as a consultant, they asked me to go down to the schools in the South to see how integration was going. Whether in fact, then I was supposed to go sort of unannounced and just sit in on classes and find out whether or not there was any integration and so on, and then send a report back. That was my job, and they paid me by the day to do that. And I got to Columbus, Mississippi, and I did all the things I had to do, and I checked it out. I sent my report in. And I had heard that my father had died, but I hadn't had it confirmed, but that it had been in New Orleans, and that's the only thing that I had known. So I started calling, and I called the infirmary, one of the infirmaries in New Orleans, to find out that information. And they said, yes. I finally, after a lot of phone calls, I said, yes, he died in, and they gave me the year. And I said, well, where is he buried? What happened? I mean, I want to see, is my name on the death certificate as one of his children? They said, well, only records we have here, because they're too old now, it had been about 15 years or so. They said, his body was shipped to Biloxi, Mississippi. Now, I was only 4 hours from Biloxi. And I looked on the map, and I said, I'm going to Biloxi, and I'm going to find out. Now, this story is, get ready, okay? I'm going to turn the lights out a little bit, because this will start making you wonder about what you're doing here. Anywhere, what you're doing anywhere. I decided to rent a car, all right? I had flown to this place. And so I went and rented a car, and it was a 1974, it was a brand new car, Dodge Coronet Blue. And I looked at the odometer, and there was 0.00 point like 0.8 of a mile on this car. Now, what the hell did they do? Make it here? I mean, what is this new car doing in Columbus, Mississippi? I didn't understand that at all. And I just kind of made a mental note of it. And I reached down. I wanted to put my seatbelt on. Okay? So I reached to get the seatbelt. And in those days, they didn't have the shoulder harness things. They just had a belt that went across to your lap. So I reached in to get the seatbelt, and I couldn't get it out. It was encased in plastic. I literally had to take the seat out of the car to get at the seatbelt, because I wasn't going to go. It's one of those things that I just won't get into a car and drive without a seatbelt. So I reached down in there and got the seat out in there, and I pull it out, and it's all wrapped around, and there's a rubber band around it, and it's in plastic. So I took the rubber band off, And inside the wrapping is a little card, a little business card. And it says, Candlelight Inn, Biloxi, Mississippi. Okay? There's no miles on this car. So I said, all right. I really, at the moment, didn't think anything of it. I really didn't. If you think you got shivers now, just wait. I'm going to take you to Shiverville tonight. And I put the card in my pocket, and I didn't think any more of it. Got in a car, drove down to Biloxi, picked up this guy hitchhiking who was a migrant worker, drove him over to Jackson, Mississippi, I think it was Jackson, and took a little side trip. And it was Friday afternoon, and it was 4:45 on Friday afternoon that I arrived at the outskirts of Biloxi, Mississippi. So I go to a standard gas station right on the outskirts of town. I go into the Yellow Pages, and I said, I'm going to call the three cemeteries here in Biloxi, because there's only three, and find out if Melvin Lyle Dyer is buried here. So I called the first one. No answer. Long, long time. No answer. I called the second one. Busy. Busy, 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 busy. Okay. So I called the third one. Long, long time ringing, and finally the phone answers. I said, I'm calling. My name is Wayne Dyer, blah, 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 and I'm calling to find out if a Melvin Lyle Dyer... He left. He said, I'll be back. And he went away for the longest time. He finally came back. He said, yes. Ugh, my heart just ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom. I mean, it was like the end of a journey. And it was a lifetime journey. I said, all right, now I got to get there. How do I get there? He said, oh, it's very easy. He said, just look for the Candlelight Inn. He said, we are on the grounds of the Candlelight Inn. And I reached in my pocket just like this. And I said, you mean so-and-so? And he said, yes, that's it. Now, that's a true story. And I went there, and I stood on the grave. I found the place, and I stood there, and I talked. And I had a dialogue with this man whom I had never met before, whose picture I had never even seen. I had never even seen what he looked like. All right? And I had this long, long dialogue. And what I did during that time was to forgive him for everything. For everything that he had done. To my mother, to my brother, especially my oldest brother, who he had done a lot of horrible things to, and anything that he might have done to... I didn't know about forgiveness or how important it was or whether I should do it or anything like that. I didn't know that. I just simply spent the time doing that. And it took about 2.5 hours, and tears were coming down. I can only tell this story now without crying because I've done it a few times. It wasn't long ago when I would tell this story and I would be a wreck. You'd have to carry me off. So this business about forgiveness. Now, I want to tell you that whatever you got going for you in your life, in the way of animosity or bitterness or anguish or pain or whatever, towards any other human being on our planet, whoever they are and what they've done, that the toxic reaction to that bitterness, it will never let go of you. That forgiveness is like the greatest motivator, if you will, in the world. Towards anyone or anything, hanging on to anything painful or hurtful and so on, I personally believe you've got to let go of. Not only do you have to let go of it, you don't have to make any phone calls. You don't have to let anybody else know that you're doing it. In your heart, you have to purify yourself in such a way that you just simply say, love is forgiving. And that's two words, and it's one word. When it's one word, it's love is forgiving. All right? And that's what it is. You must forgive. And it's also forgiving. So you don't ask anything back of it. After I did that, my whole life became so clear and so focused, and where I was going became so evident, and I left there, and I outlined my book the following week. And let me tell you that I have never had a dream about my father since. I have never had a moment's anguish of any kind toward him or anything that he has done. In fact, I am completely at peace with him, and I send him love wherever he is, whatever is going on in who he is and where he is and what it is. It's all fine. It's all okay. In fact, without those experiences that were the result of some of the things that he had done, my opportunity to help so many people and to create wonderful things for others, including myself, would never, ever have materialized without that. And I see that, and I see the need for that, and I believe in it. And I also want to say to you, whatever you got inside of you is not the result of what anybody else puts there. It's the result of what you decide to have inside of you. Think for a minute about an orange. And when I've given this analogy many times, you take an orange and you squeeze it as hard as you can squeeze it, you know, just, all right? And what comes out? These are easy questions, folks. Honest. Don't look puzzled. Everybody passes. All right? Nobody fails tonight. What comes out is orange juice. But the question is, why, when you squeeze an orange real hard, does orange juice come out? And the answer to that is, because that's what's inside. These are really easy. They get easier. All right? Now, does it matter who squeezes? Does it matter what instrument you use? Does it matter what time of the day you do it? Does it matter how you do it? When you do it? No. When you squeeze an orange, what comes out of an orange is what's inside. When you squeeze a person and put pressure on a person of any kind, and anger and hatred and stress and tension and depression come out, it isn't because of who is doing the squeezing or when they do it or how they choose to do it. It's because that's what's inside. And if you don't have it inside, it can never come out, no matter who you're living with. No matter how tough it may seem to you. And when somebody cuts you off on the freeway, and you're mad as hell and going to get even with them, and you're going to get up in front of them and slow down and make them see what it's like, it isn't because they cut you off that you're so upset. It's because that's what you carry around inside. And when you stop carrying that around inside, nothing that anybody does can upset you. No one can make a fool of you without your consent. Eleanor Roosevelt. No one can depress you. No one can make you anxious. No one can hurt your feelings. No one can make you anything other than what you allow inside. You see, my evolution has brought me to the point of understanding that each human being on our planet must take total responsibility for his own inner development. For his own inner development. And our inner development is something that we ignore a lot as we progress through this whole ladder of life. And I think of a metaphor. The metaphor is like a candle and the candle flame that is burning inside of you. All right? Now, this candle flame, if you take a candle and walk out of here this evening and you see raindrops falling, it'll blow out your candle and the wind will blow out your candle. There's all kinds of things that are going to happen outside of you that you have absolutely no control over to blow out your candles. Your candles are getting blown out all the time. We have an inner candle flame that must never flicker, though the worst goes before us. And that's perhaps the highest place we can get to in our lives, is to understand that what our own inner development symbolized by that candle flame must never change, must never even flicker. It is our responsibility, not only for ourselves, but for our children as well, to raise them to believe that whatever is going on inside of you is entirely up to you. You own it. It is yours. I'm going to give you another truth.
Everything that is happening to you, whoever you are listening right at this moment, everything that's happening to you in your life, you have a voice in. You are creating. If you're not getting along with somebody on the job, if you're having difficulty in your relationships and feeling victimized, if your children don't respect you, look at yourself first and say, what is it about me? And what can I change in order to help myself not feel victimized? Not how can I get them to change? How can I make the world different? It's one of the fundamental problems is that people want the world to be different than it is. The world is perfect. There's no anxiety in it. There's no depression in it. There's no stress in it. Contrary to anything you've heard, the world is not a stressful place. It's a perfect place. You are a part of that world. You are part of the universe. Your perfection is also in your own creation. You're not a mistake. None of it is. There's only anxious thinking. There's only stressful thinking. There's only angry thoughts. There's no anger in the world. When you stop having that and replace that with this serenity I'm talking about, with this peace inside of yourself, you don't even know how to be victimized anymore. It's not like you learn all these strategies. You become healing instead of becoming poisoned. You are effective rather than trying to get there. You live it. You see, when you get enough inner grace or inner peace or serenity, whatever you want to call it, you feel really positive about yourself, it's almost impossible for you to be controlled and manipulated by anybody else. I'll give you an example. Just yesterday, I had to get on an airplane and fly to Chicago. Now, I got on the airplane at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in Fort Lauderdale. The plane took off and flew for 30 minutes, and they couldn't retract the landing gear. They were stuck in the down position, so they had to land the plane in Miami, go back and landed in Miami because they had longer runways. It wasn't an emergency, but I wasn't convinced that they had that foam out there on the runways because they were just seeing if their foam equipment worked. They were trying to convince us there was no emergency and that those ambulances weren't just standing by in case anybody fainted while they watched us land, that there was, in fact, some emergency. I watched people around me on the plane when we were having to do this, and some people were panicked and fearful and scared. There was one couple that jumped and screamed, and there was a lot of interesting reactions, a lot of ashen looks and a lot of very scared people. And I looked at myself, and I didn't have any of that. I didn't have any of that. It was okay. And I knew I was going to be okay, and I saw myself being okay. It wasn't that I tried very hard not to be fearful. It was that inside of me, there is something that has replaced that fear, and that is called grace or serenity. And it was okay. It was just simply all right, and I was fine. In fact, I was effective. I calmed down the guy next to me. I looked around to see where the emergency exits were, because I wanted to know how to get out of this place. I used my mind in a situation where other people might elect panic. I was electing to be conscious, to be intelligent, to save myself if necessary, and I wasn't the least bit afraid. And I know I would have been afraid at an earlier time in my life. That fear, that potential for fear, has been replaced by peace and fulfillment and knowing that when it's my turn, and that's okay too, and that I'm not afraid of any of that. So we landed, okay, and everything was fine. And there was a computer part that was missing that wouldn't give the right signal for the landing gear to go up, so they had to replace the part, and they canceled the flight. And 192 people were on this plane, and it was full. It wasn't an empty seat. It was the last week after Easter break. There's no seats out of South Florida at all. They announced, the first thing they did was announce that there would be nobody getting a seat out of South Florida because you just can't get one on all the airlines. They're all filled up. And you probably will have to be here a couple of days until we can do something about it. And they even announced that they weren't going to put us up in a hotel. There was like all of these negative things coming out of these victimizers who work for the airline. And I watched the people around me. Now, a minute ago, they were worried about whether they were going to be alive. Now, suddenly, they're alive and they're relieved about that. Now, they're angry because the plane isn't going to take off or they're going to have a replacement. And so there's all this anger. Now, I believe in looking for solutions, never looking for problems. So when the plane landed, they said, no one can get off the airplane. But I knew they probably weren't talking to me, okay? Because as soon as it landed, the door opened, I went out and called my secretary and said, I have to give a speech tomorrow morning in Chicago, and there's a lot of people depending on me to be there. There's 500 people waiting to hear me speak, and we've set up this date in advance. I see myself in Chicago. I know I'll be there. 191 other people didn't believe they would be in Chicago and acted just that way. They were angry. They were upset. They were yelling at the people. They were letting their blood pressure get out of control, and they weren't doing anything. I said to my secretary, I will call you back in 15 minutes. She was in Fort Lauderdale. I'll call you back, collect, in 15 minutes. Just make sure I have a seat on a plane, no matter what it costs or what the inconvenience or what it get me a seat. At the moment that she called, somebody the moment before had canceled on another airline a first-class seat. They had just canceled, they weren't going. And I was able to get that seat because the person that she called handled the cancellation, and she just replaced me on there, okay, instead of going through the whole list. And I had a seat on a flight that was 5 hours away. But I still had a seat on a flight to get in much later than I anticipated. I went down and got my boarding pass, and I was out of 192 people, there was only one that made it to Chicago. And I was that one, not because I'm smarter than everybody else, or because I know anything that other people don't know, or because I'm better than anyone else. It was because I look for solutions, not for problems, and I refuse to be victimized by my need to be right through using anger and being upset and so on. When you are able to visualize yourself doing something, you start acting on that visualization or that image. You're able to make things happen when you're looking for solutions that you can never make happen when you're more preoccupied with being a victim.